Okay, we were told we have an hour to do this. So this particular panel is called The Impact of Caribbean Culture on America. It has a secondary title, Through the Voices of Caribbean American Performing Artists. We're actually fortunate, and we want to thank Dr. Claire Nelson for, again, her vision and putting together this amazing afternoon of so much knowledge. I'm too impressed with the last group and their amazing brilliance. But I want to say that we're ready to rock now. This is going to be the panel that really opens up to show you how culture has an impact on development, how it works with economic sustainability. And we want to say that we are really proud that we have the kind of presenters who are internationally renowned. We have Marshall Montano, who is actually, we had the Oni of Ife earlier. We have African royalty, we have Caribbean music royalty in the house. So we're really pleased to have Marshall Montano. We also have Emmeline Michelle, similarly from Haiti, amazing presenter. So if you would come forward, I'll be pleased. Marshall Montano, please come forward. Emmeline Michelle, Etienne Charles, amazing performer, composer, professor of music, jazz musician. And there's another person, I don't know if that person is here, Ryan Leslie, is he here? Marlon? Please have a seat. Yeah. Yes, you can be first. So basically what we want to do is engage our panelists with a few questions. I want to begin, though, by just saying, telling you a story that links with the fact that you had the Oni of Ife here today. And that is that when I was a grad student, I did my PhD in African literature at the University of Ibadan in Nigeria. So I recognize this royalty is really significant. However, I was traveling between Ghana and Cote d'Ivoire. If any of you have done that by road, you go north and then try to cross the border. I had a Trinidad passport, and I tried to explain who I was. I was with an African-American who they recognized because she had an American passport. They looked at my Trinidad passport and said they had no idea what this is. And I spent quite a bit of time trying to explain in my French, bad French, what I was and who I was and where I was coming from. And I explained and explained, and eventually I said, Bob Marley. And they said, ah, listen to it. So really, music has a way of traveling internationally and giving you access globally. So I think it's such an iconic story that I always love to share it, and I mentioned it in my book, Caribbean Spaces, recently. I'm a professor at Cornell University. I'm honored to be able to interact with this group of speakers this afternoon. But I want to say that I'm just coming back from the Caribbean Studies Association, which was held for the first time in Haiti after 41 years. And would you believe it actually turned out to be the largest CSA in history, in spite of warnings about Zika, about potential unrest, about, you know, all sorts of problems. People came, and I want to say, and I was pleased to listen to Haitian American scholars talk about their contributions. People came and they wanted to be in Haiti. And actually, every time you go to Haiti, you realize that we're living in a major media construction which churns out information about Haiti, actually designed to make us see Haiti constantly in negative light and to reproduce it consistently as one of the worst countries in the world. Haiti is a dynamic country, a lot of energy, a lot of brilliance, creativity everywhere. Make sure you put Haiti on your list of places you have to go to. And just one final thing, we took Angela Davis to Haiti for the first time, and she was like royalty in Haiti. And one of the things she said, just as people go to see the slave castles all around the world, you need to go and see the citadel, because that's where Haiti showed that it vanquished the largest army at the time in the world. So make sure the citadel is on your list. You will see the cannons that the Haitians took from the Spanish and from the French, and showed basically that they were able to claim themselves as human beings in the world. So how does culture impact us? Caribbean global movements are really significant. Caribbean people are global people. And we want to say that music is one of the ways, as we indicate, that we globalize ourselves. So I want to ask our panelists if we could begin with that question and talk about how you see Caribbean music making these same global movements that our people make around the world, that our art makes around the world, that our food goes around the world, that our hot sauce makes journeys around the world, to the point that Hillary Clinton says she carries hot sauce in her bag, Beyonce did too. And so essentially we are global people with all kinds of cultural movements, and music is one of the strongest of them. So I'll start with Michelle Montano. Yeah. It's not on?
Check. I'm usually good with microphones. Hi, my name is Marshall Montano. I'm a musician, singer, songwriter, producer, entrepreneur, and most recently, I'm an actor with my first feature film being released on August the 5th, entitled Bazodi. It's about you know, being crazy in love, and meaning that love can make you do crazy things. And the crazy thing that this love in this movie is making us do is cross race relations between Africans and Indians, between the rich and the poor, and between the upper class and the lower class. This is a movie that is going to be presented as a Caribbean influence to the rest of the world. So I'm very proud of that. I just wanted to share a bit about my journey musically, because I started off singing calypso in Trinidad and Tobago back at the age of 7. And at the age of 9, I was able to open for Mighty Sparrow and Lord Kitchener in Madison Square Garden. So I was pushed into the professional world very early. Early in that, I realized that calypso was really loved by the more mature crowd. And I tried to reach out for my younger fans, and they weren't really interested in the music of their nation. They were more in love with R&B and dancehall and, you know, Bell Biv DeVoe, New Edition. And it was a challenge for me, but right there in that challenge, and I wanted to understand why, you know, they didn't love their own. And I was forced to pause and decide the rest of my life, am I going to sing R&B, hip hop, or am I going to try to solve this challenge? And I had to, you know, find out that then my purpose was to take my culture and advance it, to make it acceptable worldwide, to make it trendy, to make it hip, to make it beloved. This has been my journey. I've therefore pushed the envelope to take Caribbean music to the corners of the globe. And yes, and I'm still on that journey, I would say. You know, it's my life. And what I realized was that, you know, we had to try to grow. We had to try to develop. And, you know, I saw a lot of the panels here talking about the impact on America that we have had as Caribbean people. But, you know, I also would like to start about the impact that America has had on us. You know, because we have been looking up at these superpowers and thinking, you know, hey, sometimes we want this American dream. And the American dream for a musician is the wider audience. You know, it's stardom. It's making it to the Billboard charts, which have all been some of my goals. But for basic families, you know, it's been about getting better education for their kids, leaving their countries and going to New York and Miami and getting, you know, more economic stability and probably, you know, making it as a family. And we have all had our communities developed in Miami, in New York, and we have brought our culture. One of the things we have brought in a big way is Carnival. I'm from Trinidad and Tobago, and we have impacted America with Notting Hill Carnival. I'm saying not America, with Labor Day in New York, Miami Carnival, and this week on Saturday, I'm celebrating Hollywood Carnival. I'm part of the board trying to take Carnival to Hollywood. Well, what are we trying to do? You know, we are trying to bring our Caribbean culture to America. We came across here to make a better life, or to make advancements, or to grow. I have been living in California for the past 10 years, trying to meet producers like Ryan Leslie and work with them to help develop the Caribbean music. We have had people like Nicki Minaj emerge to be worldwide stars who have Caribbean heritage and grew up as Americans when their parents moved here for a better life. we now have people like Rihanna topping the Billboard charts coming out of Barbados, and it's impacting American culture. My point is, you know, we have impacted American culture by them taking on our slangs, loving our foods, loving our styles. But the gentleman here asked about, you know, how does it go back to the islands and help them develop? How have we helped develop the music industry of Trinidad and Tobago or Jamaica or Haiti? And how do we get these people to, you know, become not only dreamers of being an American star, but people who can help develop the music industry and diversify the economies in the Caribbean islands? So I've been a pioneer of that. I've been trying to help the carnivals sustain themselves but grow. I've been also trying to let this be understood that through music, we can move people and move people to have a purpose for life. I believe very much in my movement called Monk. It's a movement of new knowledge. And I believe through music, I can help get people to know each other better. I think one lady stood up here and said, we are all human beings, you know. We have been forced to think of ourselves as Haitians, Bajans, Trinis, Guyanese, when really and truly, you know, we sit here in this room and my favorite dish is pilau, which is chicken, rice, and peas. In Jamaica, they have rice and peas and jerk chicken. In, you know, with red beans. In Cuba or Dominican Republic, it's called arroz con pollo. In Guyana, it's cook-up. And I use this because I sit down and say, if we were to sit at a table, we could all boast of the unique difference and specialty of our own dish, and we could back it. Every time somebody stands up here and say they're from Jamaica, the Jamaicans go, yeah! You know, we always taught to defend what we know. And therefore, as the young lady was saying, Nancy was saying, you walk in the room and they don't really know you, you know. I think through this movement of new knowledge, it's not new knowledge, it's the knowledge of oneness, the knowledge of unity. I advocate for Carnival because it is an inclusive festival. It brings people together. It teaches them how to meet people, share with people, and love people through the music. Soca music is very much like that, embracing, loving, accepting.
Okay, thank you. Thank you so much. Can you, if you would pass the mic.
Cool.
He has the mic. Go ahead.
Yeah. Wow. Yeah. You need to sit on the other end. You need to be the last person to answer every question. Good afternoon, everyone. Everybody feeling all right?
Yes.
I know it's been a long day. Feel free to get up and stretch if you have to. Trust me. Thank you to Dr. Claire Nelson for putting this together. Seriously, let's give another round of applause. I am extremely humbled and inspired by all of the panelists thus far. And I love the question that I was asked, that we were asked, simply because it's a topic that's very special to me as a Trinidadian musician living as a migrant worker in the U.S. And I like to use the term migrant worker simply because there's a lot of talk about the different categorizations of someone who is an immigrant. So some people are called expats, right. And then some people are called migrant workers. Right. And I'm a trumpet player, composer. Like Marshall, I have my own record label, and I'm also a professor at Michigan State University. And my biggest challenge over the years, I've been in the U.S. working, studying for 14 years now, and through my musical research, it's been really enlightening as a Caribbean man, simply because the deeper I dug, the more I found West Indians at the roots of many different things that are called American culture and that are called European culture. So our brother here, Marshall, talks about Carnival, and talks about, you know, we're trying to export Carnival. But we don't need to do that. The largest outdoor festival in North America is Caribana, which is a Caribbean festival. The largest outdoor festival in Europe is Notting Hills Carnival. So we've already done our job to take our culture far and wide. But I'll take you a little, give it a round of applause. Get him a round of applause. And So I'm a jazz musician at the core. I play, you know, what is known as American music. But funny enough, in research, in travel, you learn things. And so, you know, we're talking about the cultural impact of Caribbean music on American culture. And so certain names come to my mind, and I'm sure come to yours as well. You know, people talk now about Rihanna and Nicki Minaj as the people of now, but long before them, someone who had a lot more impact, I would say, was Harry Belafonte. Who to me is the quintessential Caribbean American, simply because he was born in Harlem, raised partly in Jamaica, moved back to the US, took Calypso, sent it worldwide. Okay? First, if you don't know, Calypso, his album Calypso was the first LP to sell 1 million copies worldwide. If you didn't know that, now you do. But in addition to that, his music, he used music to get into American households, to then pitch the idea of civil rights to white America. Okay, and he did it very cleverly. His whole band, which was made up of Americans of Caribbean descent, people like Ralph McDonald, people like Bill Eaton and Bill Salter, were all marching with Dr. Martin Luther King in Selma. Okay, and there's a long list of musicians that I can call. The whole bebop movement of New York in the 40s and 50s, at the core of that movement are many West Indian American musicians. And I'll take it even further. The US State Department decided to do a program called American Music Abroad. And they called it the Jazz Ambassadors was what it was originally called. And some of the first people that went were Dizzy Gillespie, and then I think Louis Armstrong also went, and Dave Brubeck also went. And the senator that put that bill forward to President Kennedy, I believe, his name was Adam Clayton Powell Jr. I'm sure if you've been to Harlem, you've seen Adam Clayton Powell Jr. Boulevard, right? Well, a lot of people don't know is that his wife was a jazz musician. She was a very famous jazz musician. She was a brilliant pianist. Her name was Hazel Scott.
That's right.
Yep, and she was born in Trinidad. And so, not only did our Caribbean music influence American culture, our Caribbean film, our actors influence American film, but in addition to that, we also influenced American culture going abroad. So it's bigger than we actually think. So it's not just about what we do now. But the key is that we need to know these things. How many people didn't know that Harry Belafonte's record was the first album to sell 1 million copies? It's okay. I didn't know. It's fine, right? Okay, I'll tell y'all one more thing. Now, it was funny because I saw the Uni of Ife sitting here. And like Dr. Davies, I was lucky enough to get to meet his father before he passed away. And how many people have heard of Fela Kuti? Yeah, so yeah, but yeah, if you don't know him, that's cool too. Now, Fela Kuti is an icon in worldwide music, as we all know. And the most inspiring thing to me about Fela Kuti's music is that when I listen to his music, I hear Calypso. And many people hear Calypso when they hear his music. And from hearing that, I decided, okay, let me do a little research. Comes to find out that Fela Kuti, when he left Nigeria, he went to England to study at Trinity School of Music, Trinity College of Music, and he went to study classical music. He didn't really know that much about African music. And what was the music playing in London in the 50s and 60s? It was Calypso, okay? So that was the music that he heard, the black musical movement of London and the black musical movement of France were driven by Caribbean people. In France, you had Guadeloupe, Martinique, Haiti, and French Guyana, people like Henri Salvador. And then in London, you had Trinidadians, Jamaicans, Ghanaians. So you go down the list. So our music has really affected the whole world. And we're grateful to be able to continue that legacy here.
Yeah. Right. So thank you. Can you
Robert Mitchum, the actor, he had a Calypso album.
Yeah, yeah.
But don't, yeah, don't, but don't let me get started on this. Yeah, we'll get there. We'll get there.
Yeah, we can add Maya Angelou to that list. Yeah, Maya Angelou.
Get
Calypso.
There.
Okay, let's try to get all our speakers though. So if we can go next to Ryan. And if you would take the same question, but from your own point of view, of course.
Yeah. So my name is Ryan Leslie. My grandparents and my parents are both lifetime volunteers, if you will, in the service of others in the Salvation Army. My grandfather is from Holland. My grandmother is from China on my mother's side. And they met on missionary service in Guyana, where my mother was conceived. And yeah, I love Guyana. It's an amazing story. And my father was a jazz musician, actually, born in Barbados, but was raised in Trinidad. And he came to the United States to find his American dream. And he thought his American dream was that he was going to be a jazz musician in the clubs in Washington, D.C., right here. And my mother, coming from the Salvation Army, which is a religious organization, wanted to follow my father, went to Tribeca Nazarene College in Nashville, but she would come visit my father here in D.C. while he was playing at the clubs, but being very religious, she always told him, like, look, you know, we gotta wait till we get married before we consummate our love, right?
Wow.
Now, my dad was very persuasive, as jazz musicians are. And the first time that they consummated their love, I was conceived right here in Washington, D.C. Yeah, I was the consummation of their love, right? But growing up in the Salvation Army and being a product of, you know, two generations of missionaries, the idea of the Salvation Army was sacrifice in the service of others. And so over 25 years of service, they made an aggregate of about $600,000. Over 25 years, $600,000. And so my father and my mother, both being Caribbean parents, they said education is going to be the pathway to our retirement. Most people think I will say the pathway to the American dream. They say the pathway to our retirement is our two children getting into the best schools possible and taking care of us when we get old, right? So very, very early on. Now, the Salvation Army is actually organized like the military. So I'll condense my story, but I only went to high school for 3 years because my dad was pushing me through high school. I went to high school for 3 years. In those 3 years, four different high schools. I was a junior by 14. Wow. And when I was going to my senior year in Sacramento, California, the guidance counselor said, well, we don't have any classes for your son. You told your son to take all the advanced classes. He has to go to community college to finish his high school credits. And my dad said, college? That's amazing. That's what I've been preparing him for his whole life. And so at 14 years old, I applied to the 7-year medical program at UC Riverside, Davis, Irvine, Berkeley. And my dad said, why should we stop there? Harvard, Stanford, and Yale. And you know, it was an interesting conversation, because you imagine my father sitting, you know, right here where Etienne is sitting. And he said, well, Ryan, what is it that you really want to do with your life? And I thought to myself, what is the answer that he's looking for? Because otherwise, I'll be sitting here for a long time. So I looked him in his eyes. I said, Dad, I would like to be a neurosurgeon. And he said, son, I trained you well. And we applied to those schools. And I didn't get into Yale because they thought I was too young. They said, you know, at 14, you're not, you know, socially developed enough to, you know, live on your own in college. But at 15, I matriculated to Harvard, and promptly, now they should have known, because that's all we, you know, we listened to Caribbean music all the time, right? And promptly in my freshman year of Harvard, I called my father, said, look, I changed my mind. I want to be a musician. He said, no! We did everything right. What happened, Ryan? What happened?
Fela did the same. Yeah.
But Listen, the teachings. Now people say, you know, Ryan, how did you score so well on your SATs to get into Harvard so young? And it's because my father said, look, if you want to be great at something, you don't have money, you can teach yourself, put in the work, and do what you love to do, because when you do what you love to do, then putting in the work isn't really work. It's a passion, right? And so I, in my first year of Harvard, watching all the other kids who were in the pre-med program, I realized that what I loved the most and what I wanted to do the most was music. And so that's what I threw myself into learning how to do. I couldn't afford, like my friend who didn't have the money to get the equipment. I couldn't afford the computer equipment or the production equipment, but I listened. I couldn't afford to go to classes, but I listened. And in 2003, all of the work that I did while I was in school in music finally led to this moment where my CD that I had put together, a little CD, and back then it cost money to burn a CD, but my CD that I put together finally made it into a meeting, and the guy that was listening was actually looking for a single for New Edition. And so wow. The first record that he played on the CD was my song. I was singing it and everything, and it became the first single when New Edition signed to Bad Boy, and that's really where my music career took off. And in my first year of doing music, my father, you know, said, well, Ryan, you know, how's it going? I said, well, in my first year of doing music, I've made as much money as you guys have made in your last 25 years of work, and I love to retire you if you want, right? What I started to realize about music, my musical background is I make American music, so I've worked with Madonna, Britney Spears, Kanye, Jay, you name it. My first record I ever produced was for Beyonce on the Bad Boys 2 soundtrack. For me, I think coming up as a young Caribbean American, I didn't realize how incredible the training, how incredible the standards of excellence. The reason why my father wanted me to go to Harvard was the reason he wanted me to go to Harvard was because he said, yeah, you could go to the other schools, but when people look at you and they say, oh, you're from the Caribbean, your parents are from the Caribbean, you just got into school and, you know, you did school and that's nice that you worked hard. But he said, no one can really argue with Harvard, right? No one can argue with the standards of excellence that are required of every matriculating student. And so I've always been inquisitive, and to what Nancy was talking about, I started to realize that out of these sort of hotbeds of creative expression and creative thought were being born networks that would change the way that we communicate, would change the way that people are discovered, would change the way that our music is distributed, right? And I did a traditional record deal. I did two albums on Universal, the second of which was Grammy nominated, et cetera. But the sales weren't enough. I'm obviously not Nicki Minaj or Rihanna, right? So I didn't walk in here and people say, oh my gosh, can I get a picture, right? So that's how I know, let's get one.
I asked for your picture.
Right. But what I realized, is that the internet and technology are going to change even more than they've already changed. They're going to change the way that we communicate and interact as a species,
absolutely,
right?
Absolutely. Yeah. What I love is how these artists are weaving these stories. Isn't this amazing? And they're bringing in everything, the music, the training, the education, the economics. I love it. So, Emmeline, can you add something to that that will...
Yes.
I know.
Hello, everyone. How are you doing? We are grateful that you are still awake. But isn't it inspiring?
Yes.
I feel like I'm growing wings,
yes,
listening to the panelists, and we should have that for a month, exchange ideas. And I am grateful to Marlon Hill for My story, I'm going to make it very short. I was in Panama, and they were interviewing me for at the end of a big show called Africa in America. And they asked me, so what are you looking forward to? And I said, like, I'm looking forward to not see anything that goes on a wheel, whether it's a baby stroller. I want to sleep in my own bed because I just finished 20 cities touring with Jamaica and Brazil in 2 months. And then I said, unless Obama called me to say, come and sing at the White House. And I landed, God is my witness, I landed at the airport and I saw a text from my dear sister, Edwidge Nansikase. Marlon Hill is looking for you to invite you among the panelists at the White House. And I'm like, blown away by the mystic of this place and the majesty of all the stories, historical story that went down. I want to be there. But now I'm just getting the vibrancy, the such a beautiful energy that projecting us in the future of music. All Caribbean music is just irresistible, irrefutable. There's nothing that I grew up, I opened the TV and saw Celia Cruz, Larger Than Life, 20,000 people, Madison Square Garden. And I'm like, this woman, it's just transcending the languages. And for me, this is the power of music, allowing us to be under one umbrella and do a work that is beyond ourselves. Beyond, not only we are teachers, but we have a mic to connect and to get closer to each other. Mm-hmm. And what I'm getting this afternoon is like music matters, or music is powerful, and I'm just grateful to be among all of you tonight.
Wonderful, wonderful. So one of the questions that Marlon really wanted to get at as well is, how are we going to use this for future economic transcendence? What kinds of economic issues are still relevantly put forward from the artists? And I'm sure the audience will have questions that relate as well. But what would you, anybody can begin
sure.
with that question.
So to continue on my story, the two major label records. And the reason why, after my second major label record, I walked into a marketing meeting. I said, well, you know, why is it that we aren't selling as many records anymore? Why do the royalty statements look so small? why are we allowing ourselves to be streamed for free? Why are we allowing these kinds of business constructs determine the future of how we're going to be able to make a living as creators? And they didn't have good answers for me, so I wrote a check and bought myself out of my record contract. And I started a program which basically is about connectivity, right? It's the idea that a lot of cultural influencers, or influencers in general, actually probably anyone who has a voice, we build and we give our audiences to social platforms that we don't control. Mm. So we give our voices to Instagram, or we give our voices to Facebook, or we say what we want to say on Twitter. And as people adopt these platforms, we grow in following, and then our engagement gets smaller and smaller. So Oprah Winfrey has 34 million followers on Twitter, and she has a 0.01% engagement, right? Maybe less than that. Maybe 2,000 people liked her last tweet. So what happened to the other 34 million people that are following her, right? And so what I was finding is that folks that have cultural influence build large followings that they don't actually control. And when the message is important for them to actually be able to reach their audiences, they're unable to reach them because the algorithm on Facebook has changed, right? Or the algorithm on Instagram has changed. And so I decided to go on a crusade. Once again, I hadn't any real formal coding training, but I went to a code academy, taught myself how to code so that I could actually collect phone numbers on anyone that's interested in having a relationship with me. Now, people say, well, that's not that's not even that interesting, right? Because everybody has a phone number. You can always just ask people for their number, right? But there's actually scientifically a threshold of the number of people you can manage in your own mind, right? And they say in science this is only about 150 people, right? So if you have more than 150 phone numbers in your phone, you're probably not engaging and activating your network as deeply as you possibly can, right? There may be dormant relationships. There may be a wealth of relationships in your phone, people that you've met, people you've exchanged business cards with that you're just not leveraging to do the work, to have the impact, to make the difference that you want to make in life. And so I started building a platform called Superphone, which is actually how I even got into this room, because Dr. Claire sent me a text and said, hey, Ryan, look, I'm putting this panel together and I would love to have you come and speak at the White House. And so I said, well, I have something else to do that day, but I'll rearrange it so I can be here today, right? But what's interesting about it is just the fact that, you know, we do have mobile devices. We do have almost like a phone number is almost like a digital ID, right? That allows us to be to communicate with the people we love the most. And so the idea about economic empowerment really came to bear when I told all of my fans, if you want to support me, just send me a text. Send me the receipt for your iTunes, and I just want to thank you personally. And literally in one album cycle following my major label album cycle, which, by the way, on my major label album releases, we never even recouped on the 180,000 records I sold. In one album cycle, because I actually have a phone number on every single fan, from 15,000 fans over the course of a year with no label, no manager, we did $2 million in gross revenue, right? Just over SMS, over text, right? And so the power of a relationship, the power of a conversation, contact is only as powerful as the conversation you're having with the contact, right? And so the idea that technology can actually enhance the human capability of maintaining just 150 relationships to now, I think right now I'm managing 53,000 conversations on text, right, on a platform that I own. I believe that that is the start of how we can start to change the economic model for music and how the economic model for influencers can actually correlate better with the audiences that influencers have. Why is it that the most followed celebrities or the most followed influencers in the world are not the most economically empowered? Right. Now, in some cases, that may not be a good idea. Right? Working with Verizon, we saw somebody just throw somebody off the stage, right? And he lost his contract with Verizon, right? So maybe this is not the kind of empowerment that is meant for everyone. But for folks like the folks that I hear sitting here on this panel, to be able to have that kind of influence, I believe, is how we can actually empower and begin to retool the actual economic makeup for an industry that is so influential.
Absolutely. I would love Marshall to take this question too for two reasons. One, recently I know Calypsonian Stalin was very ill and they had to do fundraisers to help him with his health care. And I'm wondering, has it changed much, you would say, from your generation? I know you get tagged as being the money man.
wanted to address this because there were statements about funding and the young lady who was talking about funding. And every time we talk about funding, the room gets really excited because people need money. And I think, you know, I have learned over the years that it's not about your resources, but it's about your resourcefulness. Because I was born very poor. And I had a passion to become better. I wanted my music to reach the corners of the globe. And I thought, how am I going to do this? You know, I looked at the new editions. I looked at the Sparrows. You know, we had the future. We had the past. And I tried to figure out what would the youth need to succeed. And I found the answers in terms of my passion. I put purpose and passion behind my music, my love. And I found that commercial and financial success came as a consequence. I'm saying this because we talk about, you know, empowering the Caribbean to be financially strong and to be economically successful. But I really want to say that what is our influence on the world right now? I want to go back just shortly to the rice and peas and the jerk chicken. You know, it's all these different unique ways to cook the same three ingredients, rice, peas, and chicken. And we have spent many of our lives, you know, focusing on who we are and trying to put who we are out there as a separate people. But we have spent least amount of time, you know, relishing or spending time enjoying our similarities to really teach us that we are one, despite language, despite race, despite class. So I'm saying, and this is just oneness as that, but what about the oneness of, you talk about the past and the historic people who have influenced, and you talk about what you can do for the future, and we tie that into the present. You know, somebody who's from the Caribbean, the millennials right now have the power to respect the tradition and the technology, but put it to work now in the present, which is the only existing moment. The past is gone. You know, the future is not promised. My view for Caribbean people is that we have been brought to this small little islands, 4.5 million slaves from Africa, indentured laborers from India. The only major majority of slaves went to Brazil. So they probably got the genes in soccer. We got the genes in soca, you know? and I'm saying this because I reppin' for soca and I reppin' for Caribbean music. I reppin' for what it means, really. Forget the economic. It means that we have been a microcosm that has been able to incubate different races, peoples, traditions, cultures in a tight space. Muscles with more density perform stronger when they're in these tighter spaces. So our influence to America right now, when you have somebody wanting to kick out immigrants and not understand race relations, we have worked our infrastructure and a system that worked and show us united. We have things like Carnival today, which include people and is inclusive of all people. We are here to influence them how to get along. And how we get along is by knowing each other. My reason for trying to make Carnival succeed and make soca music succeed and make the film and the dancehall come together is because we can preach unity. And in unity, there's strength in numbers. There's financial success when I hire a manager from India. You know, I hire people in my band from Venezuela and Jamaica, and we work together and we become a unit that has succeeded at making something popular. We need his technology. I met with Ryan last year to use his technology to further influence my community, as Nancy was saying. Teach them how to get successful like me. I didn't get successful running down money. I run down being the best. I run down greatness. So I'm just saying that this is what we are going to be called upon to influence. The Caribbean is going to have to influence America how to live together, how to communicate and how to share each other's culture, how to recognize each other, how to celebrate. You know, Bob Marley had to struggle against war and John Lennon. We here to teach how to love. And that is going to bring love, is going to bring prosperity. Love is going to bring success. It's not an American dream. It is everybody's dream to be whole, to be fulfilled, to be satisfied, to be happy. And I run a contentment company. You know, I sell content, and I'll sell my content to Ryan.
I love it. Can I get Emmeline to jump in on that? And I would love to see the question of how a black woman engages that similar question.
I would like to tap into the platform that represents us. Right. When I think about Caribbean radio, I'm sorry, most of the time it's like 4 or 5 hours that they bought on one mainstream radio. And this is not serving us. And I think it's about talking about the now. This is the time to really one of us stand up and have a television that represents Caribbean, but in a proud way. Not that you got to turn your TV, turn the cable a certain way to get captation. Really, no. It's one thing that saddened me because we don't have that voice, that powerful full voice we're talking about. It's almost non-existent. And at the same time, when we on stage, we exude this strength, this richness in our culture that is just irresistible. So if we can have that on TV, we can have that on our radio and make that coalition of contentment.
I love it. That's really
collaborate and expose our culture. I think this is for us ways to build that community we're talking about.
What about ATN? You want to add something there? And then we'll open it
well,
up.
Well, all the answers are great, but I can only speak for me based on my experiences, because it's about commerce, right? And it's about actual business. And it's about actual dollars and cents, and it's actually
fundings.
About numbers.
Funding,
and it's about engaging your audience, but to the point where they are willing to spend money, right?
Mm-hmm.
Right?
Right.
And the reason I look at people, and I look at you, and I nod heads, because I like making eye contact, right? It's one of the things that has gone away with the millennial generation because of the mobile device. So while I'm looking at you, you might be texting me back, which is okay, by the way. But at the same time, it has taken away value in what we up here do. Because we give our lives to music. 1, 2, 3, 4. And I could just speak that three of them have influenced millions of people with their sounds. But yet, it's hard to recoup that financially. Simply because the internet technology has made it possible for human nature, one of the negative aspects of human nature, to thrive, which is that nature to not pay for something that you don't have to. Mm-hmm. Quincy Jones said it best. He said that we are in a business to make people pay for something that they can have for free. And how do we do that? He has the answer. He has the answer. She has the answer. It's in building love. If you build love and appreciation, the same way we love and appreciate our audiences, and the same way our audiences love and appreciate Caribbean music, American music, rock and roll, is the way that we're able to, even if you mightn't buy my record, but you might see me hungry and buy me lunch. It's the same thing, right? So what I encourage you to do, how many of us in the last 6 months have gone to see at least 10 Caribbean live music concerts? It's okay. At least 10 live Caribbean music concerts. Okay? At least?
Five.
Okay. So, okay, and how many of y'all have taken your children, if you have children, to see at least 10 live, children or grandchildren, to see live Caribbean music concerts? Okay. Now, this is the real thing, and it's okay. Because the first part of fixing a problem is acknowledging that there is an actual problem. And the actual problem at hand right now is that we don't support us.
Wow.
And I mean, I'm a musician. I'm born to tell the truth. And the reason I can say that is because we work with presenters. And when we tell the presenters we're a Caribbean artist, the first thing they go to are their statistics, because the truth is in numbers. And they look at the layout of their neighborhood, and they look at the Caribbean market, and they say, oh, well, they don't buy tickets till the day of the show. So they may or may not come, because rain might fall.
Oh.
Or because they might visit. And as a result, it loses out on him getting a show at a big outdoor event in an amusement park. And it loses out on Emmeline getting booked as opposed to an American artist. And it loses out on Ryan getting booked. So it really is one movement. I always tell people, there's no difference between the band and the audience. Michelle said unity is one. It's all we. We make the music happen.
Mm-hmm.
Right? It's the same way he made a movie about Baswedi. We all made that movie. And we will only make that movie really happen by going and seeing it and buying a ticket, right?
Wow.
So we need to make sure that we support each other in everything. And if we do that, then we won't have the problem about commerce.
I just want to add to what he's saying for Caribbean people. I think it is important for us now that we have people like Ryan Leslie, who has knowledge and who has success, but he also has Caribbean roots. You know, I look at people like Rihanna making it, and I mention Rihanna because she's making it, but she's making it singing, you know, U.S. Mm-hmm. music. Mm-hmm. Same for Nicki Minaj. You know, and sometimes where I was back at 11 years old, I was forced to make the decision, should I sing Belle Biv DeVoe? Should I sing New Edition, or should I stick singing Calypso? And I went on Star Search in 1987, and I lost a little white girl singing pop. And I had the choice to work with Ralph McDonald to sing Just the Two of Us or Too Young to Soca. And I chose to sing Too Young to Soca, and I came last. The point is, I still arrived at success, and I'm still trying to find success. But I'm saying it is important for the millennials who have Caribbean roots to reach back to the Caribbean people and help them build their industries. Help us change the sound of soca so it can reach more people. My goal is to make music expressing the highest expression of who I am and take it to the corners of the globe. Take it to the corners of the globe means get paid. But not just get paid. It means share love with people, but get paid for doing that. You know, survive by doing it. So I think it's important for us to build Caribbean industries so that we don't have to sign to Atlantic Records. And as he's, Ryan is saying, we don't have to sign to a record company anymore. We could engage with him. We could put the music in the phone. We could use Google's, you know, coding and platforms to spread the music. And then as he's saying, we can go out there and support it and have a bigger voice and a bigger influence financially, economically for the world.
Knowledge. Okay.
I just have one point. One point on commerce. And I have one point on the economic viability of Caribbean culture and Caribbean. How many people know Bob Marley? It's okay. How many people know Harry Belafonte? Right? How many people know Rihanna? How many people know Nicki Minaj? Okay? These are how many people know Kassav? Right? Yeah, big up. Now, these are all Caribbean artists that have made billions of dollars for European and American record labels and not for Caribbean countries. I'll say that again. For European and American record labels have attained the lion's share of the revenue of their culture. It is something very serious
to think about
as Caribbean people moving forward into the next
subject. So we want to get you to have some questions. I know at least two on each side. Johanna's been up for a while, so you want to go ahead.
My name is Dwayne Summers. I'm Anita Antoinette's manager. I've been in the business for about 20-something years. I was Sean Paul's production manager and engineer. And as a manager for a young, upcoming artist, I've seen, you know, the top. I've been there from the beginning. Now, can you explain, like, coming from all of you up there, I've seen where Sean started out, nobody really liked him. It's exactly what you guys are talking about. He never got any support in Jamaica. The minute he signed with Atlantic Records, however, everybody in Jamaica was like, why Sean Paul? We have all the artists, why? They never liked him until the rest of the world accepted him. The same with Bob Marley. Same with Maxi Priest, the list goes on and on and on. And the reason I bring it up is because as a contestant of The Voice, I noticed she didn't get any support from Jamaica either. There were bloggers that were saying, hey, is she even Jamaican? She speaks with an American accent. When she's actually Jamaican, she was born, she grew up here, she just moved here, she's a Caribbean American. But with, you know, artists, the music industry does not get support from the Caribbean. It always has to go overseas first, and then the Caribbean comes back. Do you have any...
So your question is how can we change that?
Do you have any insight on how we can change it or make a move forward? I know the technology is changing. Like you said, we don't need record labels anymore. Just some sort of insight would help.
Okay, we'll take one more on the other side first. Yes, go ahead, sir.
Similar question I was just going to ask, with the winds being changed to where you don't need record labels anymore, the technology that exists now, it is said if you can get ahead of the trend before it really hits, you're the ones that's going to make the lion's share of money. What kind of information do we need to capitalize on and to utilize these new platforms that are there, there's a cloud. If the technology can be utilized for artists, I'm a gospel musician as well as a pastor, and you know we have quite a need for exposure. But what do we need to do? Take advantage of the technology that exists, which is going to be the new wave of the future, which is the wave of the future.
Okay, can you engage?
Yeah. Go ahead. So, I believe I could likely speak to both of these questions. Like my compadre was just talking about, at the end of the day, it comes down to real numbers, you know? So, it comes down to real numbers. And so, what most people are finding is that social numbers are not real numbers, right? You can buy a bunch of Instagram followers. You can buy a bunch of Facebook followers. You could buy likes, you could buy it. And so I can speak to my platform. My platform, I can't actually turn off the number of people who are calling me about this system because the numbers are real. They're not huge numbers. They're not millions of people. It's 53,000 people who've texted me, 45,000 people who've entered their information in my phone, and 15,000 people who are actually responsible for $2 million in revenue. Now, this is not billions of dollars, but it's the start of a clear pathway to sustainability without having millions and millions and millions of people in reach and audience, right? And so the idea is just that the numbers have to be real. So if I wanted to now, I walk to Atlantic Records and I say, look, I know every single fan, and if Facebook, Instagram, and every other platform shut down tomorrow, I can press a button and text all of them a cover to my new album, right? And with the direct communication, what's happening is, if I ask my friend right now, I say, hey, can I borrow $10? There's about a 50% conversion rate, which is happening because the message is direct. It's not one to many. It's not me tweeting, hey, I have an album. It's me saying, hey, I have an album. Do you want to buy it? I've had a 50% conversion. And so the idea is that, you know, technology is empowering that kind of relationship management. And this is something that, if you look at Salesforce, a billion-dollar company, it's relationship management. It's a salesperson saying, how do I forge the deepest engagement and relationship with someone that might be interested in spending money with me? How do I do it? A platform called Salesforce allows you to do it. We've basically, to Nancy's point, that platform wasn't built so that people who aren't technologically sophisticated can sit down behind a computer and know how to leverage that platform. And so I took it as my responsibility to sit behind a computer and say, for someone that wouldn't understand how to use Salesforce and I know how to use WhatsApp, how can I actually leverage that kind of knowledge, which is inherent in almost every millennial who knows how to text? How can I leverage that to actually put the real numbers on the board that will actually attract the kind of investment and support, whether it's from large labels or whether it's from individual fans? So a simple case in point, we put an artist on this platform. He has about 100,000 on Instagram, right? But he said, hey, Ryan, I'm not getting a lot of text messages. And I said, look, it's not the number of text messages you receive. It's the depth of the relationship that you create with the folks that are texting with you. And so he put out a proposition. He said, look, I'm interested. He actually, it was G-Jam Studios. He said, look, you know, the guy from G-Jam Studios said that I could use his studio for free, but I can't even afford to fly there. And he texted it out, and someone swiped their credit card and gave him $2,500 to go and record his record, right? And so this is really what technology can empower people to do, because if you had to actually manage all the, you know, I have 550,000 followers on Twitter. If I had to manage individually a conversation with each one of them, it's humanly impossible, right? But technology can empower it. It needs to be modified. And it needs to be developed in ways so that young filmmakers, young entrepreneurs, this applies for literally everyone, right? If I start a Jamaican patty shop tomorrow, and I go to Facebook because I want to try to build an audience, 100 phone numbers of people who are interested in Jamaican patties is more valuable than 100 likes on Facebook for my Jamaican patty shop. And so that's really what we're interested in. That's really how I believe that this kind of disparate, this kind of distance between the influencer and the money, the influencer and the people who support them, there have always been so many intermediaries. There is the record company, there is the booking agent, there is the venue, there is a person that takes a percentage of the merchandising. There are all these intermediaries, and then you add on top of it the intermediaries of the places where we give our content for free just so that we can get an audience. Mm-hmm. So we gave Instagram all of our pictures for free. We gave YouTube, we spent money making videos, gave all of those videos to YouTube for free. We gave all of our insights, all of our ideas, the things that we're talking about, the insights into our recording process, we gave those to Twitter for free. We built all of those platforms into billion-dollar enterprises, right? And we don't actually know tomorrow or today. If someone asked me, who are the 180,000 people who subscribe, Ryan Leslie, to your YouTube channel, and I want to actually get a real message to them about how amazing this has been, I might put a video on YouTube, I might get 50,000 views, but I don't know my audience. Okay. And that's because the technology hasn't been built and developed for us who are not native coders. Yeah. To be able to leverage it. And so that's really what I believe. And you know, we met last year. You looks like you're ready to follow up. He's ready.
I just wanted to help with this answer, because I get this question a lot from people. You know, young artists look at us and they ask us, you know, how did you make it? How could we make it? And that sense of making it, again, I bring it back to the American dream, because are we here sitting to figure out how is the Caribbean going to make it? How are we going to make the American dream? How are we going to become successful? How are we going to become economically empowered? How are you going to become famous? You know, each person's story is going to be unique and different. You're going to make it how you decide to make it. So I'm grateful for Dr. Nelson and everybody here hosting this, because now we can hear people and meet people who can assist if you know, be proactive about it and make it. Sean Paul made it because Shaggy made it. Shaggy was a little more crossover, and then they accepted Sean. And then Elephant Man made it because Sean made it. And they started to accept the culture in a more raw fashion. My point is, come back to Ryan, ultimately, they will love you when you make it in a record company and you're famous. People will follow, followers will follow big superstars. But are they really making it financially? Do you know if they're making it for the rest of their lives? You know, I've been fortunate that I've been signed 3 times to record companies, and I tried to make it to the Billboard charts and I didn't. But every single time I went back home and I made a difference to the Caribbean people, to the artists following me, I made them successful. You're only as successful as the people you can make successful.
Yes.
And the point about this is, our success, our making it, will depend on how much we can fulfill ourselves as a people, as each nation. How can we help the world? How can we influence America, but not just America? America influences the world through TV, radio, movies. We have to help influence the world as Caribbean people, but we have to make it. And we will make it by striving to be great.
I this is the best way to end this discussion. I know there are more questions, but there's a reception upstairs. But I love this has been the most, I'm telling you, I teach at a university in Ivy League, but this is the most enlightening discussion I've had in I don't know how long. And I thank you all for being such brilliant presenters. So Stephanie, can you announce about the reception, please?